Welcome to Life and Love in the Q, a podcast for the LGBTQIA2S+ community, those who support them, and those who just want to learn more.
Together we share the stories and the science of the space and grace to live life in full color.
I'm Jillian Abbey, proud lesbian and mother, Hay House author, queer blogger, and TikTok something or other.
And I'm Trisha Peterson. I'm an LGBTQ ally, proud mom of six, professor and researcher of identity and the social narratives that impact the way we live and love.
So open your mind, open your heart, and welcome to Life and Love in the Q.
Okay, Jill, this is our first extended episode, and I'm super excited. We just got done talking about choice and how to make sure that when we have a choice to make in our lives, especially when it comes to do with living our authentic selves, why it's so important to slow down enough and actually, first of all, make an intentional choice, but to put it into that GAP framework of goals, agency, and pathways. So as we were talking through that episode, I was thinking about, I'm a yoga teacher and I used to coach yoga for high school athletes. And the reason that the school district hired me to do that was they wanted to decrease the injuries amongst our student high school athletes. And so they were hoping that if the student athletes had some flexibility training, we would maybe be able to reduce some of the injury rates on campuses. And it was super fun. But one of the things that I noticed is that these high school students really wanted to have access to the more difficult postures. So they wanted to know how to do headstands and handstands and flying crows, like all of these more advanced postures. And so one of the things that I started to realize is that if I could teach the students, and this applies not just to high school students, but to really any yoga student, but if I could teach my students how to fall out of the postures before I taught them how to get into them, that they would know how to be safe no matter what happened in the process of trying to get into a headstand. So teaching them how to fall out of a headstand not only taught them how to stay safe if they fail, but also taught them what muscles that they would need to fall. Because if we know what muscles we need to fall, we know what muscles we need to engage to stay strong. So that's kind of just a yogi philosophy on this concept of choice, because I think what keeps a lot of people from making choices is the fear that they'll fail or the fear that they'll make a wrong choice or they'll regret their choice.
Yes.
So I'm curious what you think, especially among the LGBTQ community, and if that parable of that yoga philosophy, does that apply? Like, if you know how to fall, are you better able to come out?
Literally come out of the pose of life, of everything. Well, speaking on behalf of all the queers, just kidding. But again, I can speak from my own experience. And then a lot of people that I have chatted with and engaged with, there is this common fear, especially very early on in the process, where you start to realize like, oh, shoot, maybe I'm not straight. Oh, shoot, maybe the gender I've been living my whole life isn't really the one that is appropriate for me. And then people question, how do you know? I think that is actually the number one question that I get from people on my blog, on TikTok, everything. How did you know that you were lesbian? And I still don't entirely have a great answer for them, except that I do know that it is true. But there was so much questioning along the way. And again, you've read through my book, like the questioning process went on more than a decade.
It was so long. I'll be honest, I was really, really surprised at your journey because I'd never heard anybody talk about it in that way. So yeah, I didn't realize it was so long when I first met you. I thought it was pretty fast.
Well, I'm a perfectionist and really played into the social norms pretty heavily of like, no, I will live the perfect straight life. And I'm stubborn as all get out. So yeah, so my process did take a lot longer than the average bear. But the questioning, I think, is still there for everyone. And there's a lot of fear around. And I remember saying it myself, what if I am blowing up my entire life for something that's not true? Like, what if I think I'm gay? And then I finally get into a same-sex relationship and I go, oh, nope, I just don't like sex. Or, oh, I just don't want to be in a relationship with anyone. because it's such a huge change, and because coming out affects so many aspects of our lives, socially, our family life, our relationship with our children, our relationship with our spouse, how society views us, our safety in our communities. It's a huge decision to make. I understand why people don't take it lightly. So that questioning, that going back and forth of, well, what if I'm wrong, is what keeps a lot of people stuck and confused.
Well, you just said something I'm curious about. Do you know how long the process is? Like, I know the statistics on unwed partnerships, that long-term unwed partnerships, that women will stay in an unfulfilling relationship for 2 years before they make the decision to break off a relationship. And in marriage, it's 6. The statistics show that it will take a woman 6 years to actually admit to anybody that she is feeling distressed or unsatisfied or unhappy in her marriage. So those are just the 2 statistics that I know, but I'm wondering, do you know the statistics on how long it takes for women or men, really, but in that coming out journey, if you are in a heterosexual relationship, do you know what the statistics are on how long that takes people?
I have no idea. I'm not saying that the statistics aren't out there, but I do try to research the heck out of everything related to LGBTQ in the coming out process. And I haven't seen anything, but I'm also not surprised at that, because there are a lot of women, especially who consider themselves bisexual or pansexual, where they view their coming out process like, well, do I even need to come out? I'm already in a relationship. I'm fine in that relationship. Does coming out have to be a part of it? There's some people I met where they realize that they're queer because they meet someone else and they go, oh my gosh, that's what we call the catalyst. So they meet their catalyst and all of a sudden it is like light bulb goes off. I'm queer, and they end their marriage and they start over. For me, I was dealing with so many layers of shame and perfectionism and compulsory heterosexuality, which we'll talk about in later episodes. The biggest one, I think, honestly, was internalized homophobia, which we've talked about a bit, where I knew that I was queer for quite some time. I mean, years. We're talking years and years and years, but I wouldn't accept it. And so there's so many factors that come into play that, and also on top of that, let's add another layer to this crazy sandwich here. I had a pretty happy marriage and a healthy marriage in most respects. So yeah, I don't even remember the original question now, besides that, well, it is so complicated.
The question was about statistics, if you knew the statistics, but as you were just kind of talking through all of that, the thing that keeps coming to my mind is it takes us between 10 and 20 years, which is one of the parts of academia that just drives me batty, but it takes about 10 years for us to get what we know in academia into the public conversation, just because of the way it just how long it takes for the dissemination process to take place. So I'm actually going to look into the academic research, because like you said, you research the heck out of stuff. Just because you haven't found it just means that it hasn't been disseminated.
Right.
But I feel quite confident because I know what the LGBTQ research looks like on the academic side. I know the conversation has to be there. I'm going to find it.
This is exciting.
Yeah, I'm curious.
I'm so glad I paid for this bonus podcast. So going back, though, there are a lot of reasons why it's hard to figure out our sexuality. I mean, there's a lot of layers to it. You and I have talked in the past about the role that religion plays in how we view sex and sexuality and attraction. But there's a line in a lot of, you know, anytime somebody poses the question in these late to gay support groups, well, how do I know if I'm a lesbian, or how do I know if I'm attracted to women? They're like, if you think you are, you are. So basically, like, and think about it this way. When a heterosexual person says they're attracted to somebody of the opposite sex, nobody says, well, how do you know?
Yeah.
Are you sure you're attracted to that person? And so there is a lot more questioning that just comes with being LGBTQ, because it goes against the social norms. But at the end of the day, I feel like a lot of people do know what they're attracted to. People know what their type is. People know the physical responses they feel to others, types of people. I don't know. Is it that confusing? Is it that simple?
That's all I have, is a sigh. Like, I'm putting all those questions up against my son and just what I know about his journey. And granted, I don't know all of his journey. And as he's started to open up a teeny little bit more to me about what that journey has been for him and how much our church literally bullied his experience out of him. And there was just so much shame involved. I agree. I think intrinsically, we already know the answer. I believe that with everything, though, not just our sexuality and our gender identification, but I believe it's with everything. I think intrinsically, we already know the answers that we need in our lives.
Yeah.
But when we have to put that up against the social narrative, the hierarchy of social narrative, like my priest knows better than I do, or my parents know better than I do, or my male partner knows better than I do. There's a hierarchy of wisdom in our world as well, not just social narrative, but then that the keeper of the gate.
Yeah. And I think that's a great point. So if you're asking the question of, am I gay? Am I queer? Or whatever your question may be, I think maybe sitting with just, why could I be questioning this? What is causing me to question? And then it's interesting too, because, like, you know, in a lot of these cases, it's like, well, if you've already come to this social media site that you've joined and you're putting the question out there, like you said, chances are, you know what the truth is. And at the same time, you may be hoping that somebody in the group says, well, no, it's possible you are straight and you just fell in here by accident. You know, or like, I've heard a lot of people say that their grandmothers, they've come out to their grandmothers and their grandmothers are respond with something like, well, don't all women find other women just really attractive?
Mm.
Well, no, I mean, yeah, we can look at people and say, oh, that's a beautiful person or whatever, but not everybody has an attraction to same sex or opposite sex.
When I work with women who are struggling to kind of break free of the ideal norms of motherhood, I have them draw an avatar of who they think the perfect mom is, and to, like, what does the perfect mom do? So I kind of make them draw, like, a little, you know, a paper doll with all of these narratives around the paper doll. What do you think the ideal mom should be doing? And then I have them go through and either write who was the first voice of that narrative or who was the first image of that narrative. So where does that narrative come from? I believe that the ideal perfect mom always has hot cookies for her kids after school, and they sit down at the table and eat hot cookies and drink cold milk and do their homework together. That image came from somewhere.
Yeah.
So where did that come from? And I think what you're saying, that's a great way to look at this from the LGBTQ perspective too, is what does the ideal relationship look like? Who am I when I am authentically being loved by somebody else? Well, I'm supported, or it's cis or whatever, but we can really start to look at that from the lens of, what are the narratives that made us believe the things that we believe about ourselves? And then who voiced that first narrative for us? And that can help us start to break those narratives down a little bit.
Yeah, there's a lot of stories that we're and I think it's exciting now that we're having these big shifts in society and we're having more conversations and more people are chiming in and saying, oh, you feel that way. I feel that way too. Because it helps us realize sometimes that these stories were just stories that we were told about what sexual orientation is, what attraction is, what love is.
And I'm almost wondering if we can start to, like, maybe that's the very easiest. It may not be the easiest, but it may be the best way to then be able to break through some of those narratives. Because I think a lot of the fear of what if I'm wrong comes from, what if I'm wrong by going against this narrative?
Yes.
The reality is we can't make mistakes in this life. We've been told that we can make mistakes, but there is no such thing as a mistake. There's opportunities to pivot, and there's opportunities to reframe, and there's opportunities to start again, but we don't make mistakes.
I don't know, though, because that second slice of cheesecake I had after dinner last night felt like a mistake, but that's a tangent. But yeah, so then let's talk about it. So what if, though? So it's not necessarily a mistake. It's a choice we're making. Going back to LGBTQ, what about the people who are questioning their sexual orientation and are finally saying, okay, I realize that I need to come out to, whether that's just my partner or family members or whoever. What if they're wrong? Then what? How do you fall out of the pose of coming out and then going, actually, you know what? I had a same-sex relationship and apparently I'm just gay for that person and it didn't work out. Or I was in my first same-sex relationship and this is also not what I want.
So all of the Christians in the world are just about ready to go bat shit crazy on what I'm about to say. But I dated blondes my entire life. Always dated blondes. And not only did I date blondes, I dated very much surfer looking type blonde dudes my whole high school career. I think I had one brunette haired boyfriend. But I married a brunette who has a little bit more pale skin and he is not at all surfer boy look. Not at all. Did I make a mistake? Like when it comes to hetero relationships, we don't put these mistake standards on things. Not at all. I understand what you're asking, but if we can, let's pull gender out of it. Gender is what makes it seem like there's a mistake. So again, my Christians are going batshit crazy because you can't bounce back and forth, but why not?
Right. Yeah. It goes back to my favorite piece of advice from a therapist who said, so what?
Yeah.
Like, take the gay out of it. Look at it like just a relationship. You were in a marriage where there was masking and something was fundamentally broken. Doesn't matter if you loved the person. Doesn't matter if things seemed fine in all regards. There was something that was not working. And, you know, for myself, masking and the kind of spiral that sent me into. Something had to change, really. So take the gay piece out, though. So you needed to start over. So you needed to try a new relationship. In the first few relationships I tried, aside from confirming what my sexual orientation was, I will say, like, my first relationship after that at least very much answered the question for me. Yes, I'm gay. Like, I understand why people enjoy sex now. I was just in the wrong type of relationship. But from a relationship or a higher level standpoint, like, so what? That relationship didn't work out. It taught me things, but that was,
There's this parable that one of the leaders of my religion taught one time. And so I'm actually laughing that it's the parable that's coming to mind. But he was telling a story about him and his son being on an unfamiliar road late at night in an area. So like in a town they'd never been to, and it was an unfamiliar road. There was a Y in the road and they had to choose right or left. And they had said a prayer and they both felt strongly that they needed to follow the path to the right. And they got like 50 feet down the road and it was an obvious dead end. And so they turned around and went to the left. And the guy tells the story that his son got really quiet. And after a couple of minutes, the dad said, "What's the matter? You seem really quiet." And the son said, "Well, I'm just really disappointed that we must not have had enough faith because we both prayed about it and God told us to go to the right. And that wasn't the right road." And the dad said, "Well, yeah, but sometimes you have to go down the wrong road to know that you're on the right road." So it was actually better for them to have gone on the path to the right and had it be a dead end so that while they were driving on the left and they still didn't really know their way, they were sure they were still on the correct path. And I think that's exactly what you're saying. I'm in a happy hetero marriage. Everything seems to be going well, except for I am masking aspects of myself that I don't understand. I'm just going to stay here and hope it goes away. That just keeps what we talked about in the beginning of this podcast version of this episode is that keeps us in that uncertainty loop.
Yeah.
There's nothing wrong with saying I need to step out and at least explore this.
Yeah.
And I might be wrong. I might be right. But this uncertainty is never going to go away. I can't pray it away. I can't hope it away. I can't laugh it away.
It's like the father and the son sitting at the Y trying to decide which direction to go and just sitting there so long until they run out of gas and they go,
yeah,
well, this is now.
And starve to death. Yeah,
right, exactly. Oregon Trail all over again. You've got dysentery. You're done. Thank you. I think that's a great way to end, in that sometimes, like you said, there's not wrong answers. There's just different paths that we need to take. And I'm just really grateful that I had the goals, agencies, pathways, that I was able to lay those out and also have the courage to try. And even though a lot of my steps were not necessarily what in hindsight I would make the same step again, but the steps all got me to where I am now. And I'm just so happy with how life is. And I wish the same for so many of our listeners too, that they can listen to that voice inside that knows and kind of, you know, push away some of the stories, because I think that's how we end up on the truest, sometimes knowing what maybe the next right path for us to take is.
Well, one of the things that I love, there's a decision-making process that helps people if they're at the very beginning. They know that they're feeling an identity discrepancy, but they're not quite yet sure how to make those goals, especially if those goals require that somebody else might get hurt. Mm-hmm. So I'm going to make a goal to come out and live my authentic self, but that might hurt my children. So there's a process, and it's 5 steps. And first of all, you recognize the need. So let's just follow along in this. I really do need to live a little more authentically. I'm masking and it's distressful. So the need is finding a way to be more authentic in myself. And then you recognize your alternatives. So once you understand the need that you need to meet, then you can recognize the different alternatives. And we talked about those in the first part of this podcast. And then from there, you evaluate all of the possibilities, which again falls into that gap framework, but really allowing yourself to dig into the worst case, the best case scenarios. What are all of the different ways that this can play out? And it's after you've done those 3 things that you're finally able to make a decision. But if you skip those 3 steps, again, it loops you and it keeps you looped. But then this is the part that I love about decisions. The 5th step is to reflect on, now you've made the decision, you've started down that path, like the story, and now I reflect and evaluate, is this still the best step for me? And then the decision-making process ends with a new decision. And sometimes the decision is to stay on my path. Sometimes the decision is to get off my path. And sometimes the decision is, I'm going to reflect in 6 months. I'm going to pause decision for another 6 months. And I think that's the piece, again, that people don't really understand, that the decision-making process when it comes to our sense of self is a lifelong journey. It's not like we wake up one morning and we make a choice. We make a choice to be hetero, or we make a choice to be gay, or we make a choice.
It's Gay Tuesday.
Yeah. That's not the way it works. Right. And the way I've been advising my kids too is to create relationships where they are reevaluating their partnership decisions about every 3 to 6 months, because anytime something changes, our life paradigm changes. It's like playing Jenga. Every single time we get a new job, or we move to a new house, or our kids start school, whatever it is, we pull some of those Jenga pieces out of our tower. And about every 3 to 6 months, if you really think about your life, it's about 3 to 6 months where that tower falls down and we have to rebuild. And it's not bad. It's actually so adaptive if we would start living our lives that way. Okay, let's reevaluate. Mm-hmm. Are there new decisions that need to be made now?
Yeah. So it's not the dead end. It's just a changing course here.
Yes. Never a dead end. Never a dead end.
Fabulous note to end on. Thank you, Dr. Krisha. Thanks, Q Crew.
Bye.
Thank you for listening to Life and Love in the Q. If you enjoyed today's episode, please be sure to like, subscribe, and share. And if you have questions, contact us at lifeandloveinthequeue@gmail.com. Until next time, Q Crew.